mindedness of the devil, one of the two. Is that off?
See, the first thing as we start, I want to pass out one file to you, and let me tell you what I'd like to have you do with it. I'd like to have you write your name on it. Actually, what it is, it's a test, but you don't have to take it today. What I'd like to have you do is sometime in the next couple of days, sometime before next Thursday, I'd like to have you complete it. It'll take most of you about 10 minutes, to do it. And if you want to use a book to do it, you can. And it's pretty much self-explanatory, but let me pass it out. Now, some of them are printed only on one side, and some of them are printed on both sides. So if you get one that doesn't have two pages to it, don't worry about it. It's basically the same thing. Would you fellas like to pass these out? Maybe one card on each side? It's not a real accurate map. It's drawn kind of roughly, but on the back, it will give you the directions. Part one, there are bodies of water. There are 15 of them, and you need to identify them. And then part two, there are about 5 or 6 mountain ranges. You need to identify them. And then part three, looks like there's about 7 or 8 major Bible lands, and you need to identify them. Now, one hint, I would like to have you use the names that I gave in class and not more modern terms or modern names. So we're pretty much looking at the names and the terms that I gave in class. This is file number 4, test basic Bible lands. So you go ahead and fill that out, and you can pass it in the next Thursday. And then also on Friday now, a week from today, is that on Friday or Thursday? That was Thursday, okay, excuse me. On Thursday, a week from yesterday, we're going to have that test on the introduction. So this will help you even a little bit, even though you're not going to have to fill in a blank map. Yes? Here. Yes, that's right. So everything I talk about from today on is not going to be on that. That's right. Well, yesterday when we closed, we talked about 6 major governments that dominated Bible times, and we talked about Egypt and Assyria and Babylon, Persia, the Greek Empire, and then Rome. And then also what I wanted to mention is that the boundaries of these empires are going to vary depending on the period of time being viewed. And you need to be aware of that. In fact, you need to learn, when you look on a Bible map, you need to learn to look at what period of time is written on the map. For example, this says the ancient Near East in the time of the Assyrian Empire. Now, what that means is that Assyria is going to cover a much broader area than it normally would, because it's a world empire now in Bible times. Normally, it just occupied this area down here, but now it's much broader. Well, the same will be true of the other maps as well. So you just want to learn to look at that. And if you're interested in the various areas that were covered by these world powers, you can look in Haley's Bible Handbook, page 40 and 41. They've got some maps there showing each of these 6 governments and the amount of land that they covered at the height of their reign. That's Haley's Bible Handbook, pages 40 and 41. Well, with that in mind now, what we're going to do, we're going to go back and we're going to talk about the ancient Babylonians and Assyrians. We're going to begin our discussion on people and lands, and we're starting with Mesopotamia. And the reason we're going to start there is that pretty much is the cradle of civilization. So we're not going to follow the order of world governments. And, of course, the first world government is Egypt, and then it goes to Assyria, and then it goes to Babylon and so forth. So we're not starting with Egypt, because actually civilization began here and not down here. It began here, and then people migrated down there after the flood, and then it became a world power. So we're going to start with Mesopotamia, with Babylon and Assyria. Now, this term Mesopotamia, it means between the rivers. Between the rivers, it was coined by the ancient historian Herodotus, who was a famous historian that we talked about in our introduction. And he gave this name to the broad plains between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. And they are bounded by the Zagros Mountains here on our map on the north. And then on the south, there is the Persian Gulf. So the Zagros Mountains are right here, and the Persian Gulf is right here. and the mountains of Armenia are up here, and the Arabian Desert is right here. And so this region of land in between these two rivers, a very fertile region, was called Mesopotamia at one time. Now, later on, especially in modern usage, the name came to include the entire Tigris-Euphrates region. So this entire area now, and so it's a much broader term today, and it includes most of what we know now as modern Iraq. Well, the interesting thing here is archaeologically, and as far as anthropology is concerned and so forth, that history places the cradle of human civilization here. In other words, this is where it all began. It all began. This is the oldest center of civilization in the world. Now, there are some authorities that do cite some other ancient centers of civilization, for example, the Indus River Valley in India, and also China and so forth, but there is no area that has the archaeological evidence that this area has behind it, as far as antiquity. So the picture is that it began here, and then people dispersed and went to other parts very early, and then started civilizations there, but of them all, this area is the most ancient. Now, the reason we're going to talk about this is because the Bible mentions several cities of Mesopotamia, talks about them. It mentions some of the significant leaders of Babylon and Assyria. And in fact, those two cultures are the very cultures that eventually brought about the downfall of Israel and Judah. So we're talking about them just by virtue of the fact that the Bible talks about them. Now, not only does history place the cradle of civilization here, and not only does archaeology, but the Bible. The Bible also places the cradle of the human race in Mesopotamia. In fact, the Garden of Eden undoubtedly was located in this area. Let me read a scripture to you, Genesis chapter 2, 8 through 14. We know that the area of the Garden of Eden was watered by four major rivers, and the Bible gives us the names of these rivers. Two of them are well known today. Look at Genesis chapter 2, 8 through 14. And the Lord God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man whom he had formed, and out of the ground made the Lord God to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So this is the original creation of man now. And a river went out of Eden to water the garden, and from thence it was parted and became into four heads. The name of the first is Pison, that is, it which compasses the whole land of Havilah. And then it says in verse 13, and the name of the second river is Gihon, the same as it that compasses the whole land of Ethiopia. Now that word Ethiopia actually is a mistranslation there. It's not the Ethiopia down in Egypt. It's a different area. And then it says in 14, the name of the third river is the Hiddekel. And then it goes on and it says in the fourth river is Euphrates. Now, the first two rivers we don't know anything about. There's been a lot of conjecture as to what rivers those are. But actually, they may have even been destroyed by the flood. They might not even be in existence today. So Gihon and Pison, we don't know anything about. But the other two rivers we do. Hiddekel, and the Hiddekel is the same as the Tigris. Same as the Tigris. And then the Euphrates River. So those are the two primary rivers that form ancient Mesopotamia. So my point being that the Bible also places the beginning of man in this same area. And incidentally, there are some other biblical references very early in Bible history to the same region. Let me mention them. In Genesis chapter 10 and verse 10, Genesis 10:10, there is a mighty hunter. His name is Nimrod. And he ruled a kingdom which included Babel, and later Babel became Babylon, Babel, Erech, and Akkad, and Kalna in the land of Shinar. Now, all those cities have actually been located by archaeologists. Very, very ancient cities that date back 3 to 4,000 B.C., right during the time of Bible creation. That's Genesis 10:10. And then in Genesis chapter 24 and verse 10, it mentions Mesopotamia. Genesis chapter 24, verse 10, Mesopotamia is mentioned. Now, here the Hebrew is the word Aram Naharayim. And it would be spelled like this. This is the word translated as Mesopotamia. And this is the Hebrew word now. And the first word is A-R-A-M, and then the second one is N-A-H-A-R-A-I-M. And what this means is Aram of the two rivers. Aram of the two rivers. And it's talking about the land of Aram. And again, it's talking about this area here, Aram of the two rivers. Aram of the Two Rivers. So the same region. And then there's another reference in Genesis chapter 25 and verse 20, Genesis 25 verse 20, where we read about Padan Aram. And that word Padan simply means fields. So it's talking about the fields of Aram. And that would be talking about the actual land now of Mesopotamia. So that's Genesis chapter 25 and verse 20. So just keeping that in mind now, that not only does the Bible talk about this being the cradle, but archaeology concurs with that, I like to begin talking about the first real early group of people that archaeologists know about that lived in this region. Very interesting group of people. They're called the early Sumerians. The early Sumerians. They date way back to the time of 3,000 to 3,500 BC or so. Very, very ancient Sumerians. And that's spelled S-U-M-E-R-I-A-N-S, the Sumerians. Now, be careful that you don't confuse them with what is called the Samaritans. The Samaritans came much, much later in time and are in Palestine. So it's not the same as the Samaritans. It's an entirely different group of people, no connection whatsoever. But the early Sumerians, and archaeologists have discovered their ancient ruins, and they date all the way back to about 3,500 BC. Let me tell you about them. Let me kind of paint a picture of what it was like during that time. Archaeologists know that they began building very small towns, often called city states or city towns, along the banks of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, and they were evidently engaged in a very primitive method of farming. They spoke a language unlike any other language, either ancient or modern. They had their own language. Later it's called the Akkadian language. But they spoke a language that has been hard for scholars to really break and to decipher because it's not like anything they are used to. And also they were very, very adept at writing during this time. Their writing consisted of a system of wedge-shaped characters, and they were inscribed on clay tablets. It's called cuneiform writing. If you were to look at like a clay tablet, it looks very similar to, say, something like this. And, you know, they're just kind of all kinds of different wedges, and most of them are triangles like this. And they're impressions that they made on these clay tablets with various sticks called styluses. And they made these impressions, and that was the language that they used. And that's as early as 3,000 to 3,500 BC. And of course, up until not too long ago, the liberals were asserting that language wasn't invented until, you know, they were claiming that even Moses, 1,500 BC, couldn't have possibly have written the Bible then because language wasn't even around. Well, that totally has been annihilated by the latest discoveries. And this, of course, has been known for quite some time. Now, incidentally, the cuneiform method of writing was adopted by nearly all the peoples of the Near East, and Babylon later adopted it, Assyria later on adopted it, but it was the Sumerians evidently that really developed it, and without writing, the cultural progress of Western Asia would have largely been impossible. There's no way you can really carry on an advanced society without writing, because you've got to be able to carry on your technology and your knowledge and everything, and you really need writing to do that. And you'll find that societies that don't have writing, of course, they're not advanced societies. And it is the societies that do have writing that have a real jump on the other ones. And they produced a very vast, very highly developed literature, largely poetic in nature. And if you read various things about these tablets, they have all kinds of epics and myths and hymns of lamentations. And there are proverbs, there are words of wisdom. And in one city alone, the city of Nippur, they found over 30,000 tablets. They found a whole library. And this has been quite common in all these ancient cities. They had libraries. And there's all kinds of things on these tablets. They have like contracts, bills of sale, promissory notes, you know, like I promise to pay you within a certain period of time. They have all kinds of accounts, wills, court decisions, adoptions, all these various things. Now also, they were the first to build immense artificial mountains. And a lot of these are still there in the area of Mesopotamia today. And you can look in various Bible dictionaries under Babylon, and often they'll show you a picture of these artificial mountains. But what they called them were ziggurats. Ziggurats.
called ziggurats, and really what they were used for is to worship the stars and also to worship their gods. They would often have a temple at the top with an idol in it. And they would go up there and they would investigate the stars and worship the stars. They're called ziggurats. And very often the structure of them, they look something like this. Often they are eight-layered tiered, and they go all the way to the top like this. They'll have layer after layer, and they're built out of solid brick. And of course, what remains today is maybe only about the top or the bottom two layers or whatever, and the rest has eroded away. But it's quite clear that they were layered like that. And they are immense. They are huge. Well, also during this time, the authorities say that not only were the Sumerians located in this area, but there were other groups as well, and that produced some friction with the Sumerians because they couldn't get along in full harmony. But eventually, in time, these various groups of individuals became unified and worked together. They shared a common system of writing, religious and mythological ideas, and so forth. And the next point is that the Sumerians developed, along with these other little groups of individuals, human beings, they developed what was called the township system of government, in which each town had its own method of government. It had its own governor over them, had its own official ruling over them, and they were kind of isolated from each other. You had like the city of Ur, then later on the city of Babel, and the city of Nippur, and the city of Calna, and the city of Akkad, and they were all separate from each other. Later they're going to develop into countries, but they developed what was called a township system of government, and the most important building was the temple. It was the center of everything that they did. Everything focused on the temple. It was the center of their economic life. It was the center of their cultural life and religious life. In fact, there was really no separation between, let's say, their civil and religious functions. Everything was centered right around the temple. For example, they had inside the temple workshops, and there were weavers inside the temple, carpenters inside there, metal workers inside there, and they would actually work in the temple. See, they were involved in the civil, or I should say in the secular occupations, and they were working away in the temple, and meanwhile the farmers that needed various things made and they needed to go to maybe a weaver or whatever, they would bring their crops in from the fields and they would trade with these craftsmen inside the temple. So the point is that everything centered around this temple. And then the town was ruled by a council, and then this council had a mayor over them, and he was called an ensi. An ensi. And see, they're fairly accurate, they're fairly knowledgeable about these events, and I believe that our knowledge is fairly accurate because all these tablets talk about this very thing. They've been able to decipher all these tablets, or many of them, and it describes these very points right here. But this ensi, spelled E-N-S-I, was in charge of everything. He was often the high priest. He was the head honcho. He was the town mayor, and he was the high priest ruling over the temple as well. And so the temple became the town center for worship, for education, for business, for government, everything centered around the temple. Now, let me give you an idea how extensive their culture really was. Because we've got this idea, and often it comes from liberal anthropology and so forth, that, you know, man started off like a caveman, walking around beating people over the head with clubs, and gradually evolved to a very sophisticated culture. That's really not what we see in archaeology, at least in this area. Let me show you how extensive of a culture they really had. For example, the Tigris and the Euphrates River constantly flooded. Every single year they had flood stages. And so what the Sumerians did is that they devised a system of dams and canals and irrigation systems to water their crops. And they also had laws that enforced the use of the control of water. You could only use water at certain times, and they even charged you for the use of the water. Well, that's talking about a very sophisticated society. And this is all before the flood now. They also developed and imported things like hoes and sickles and blades and spades and hammers. And these things often were made out of metal now, often made out of metal. And there's a significant point about that that I'll get to in just a moment. And then they had a standard system for weights and measurements as well. And they even had taxes. Can you believe that? And the tablets even talk about tax collectors. And the interesting thing is that the tablets bring out that
the tax collectors were no more favorable in the eyes of people than maybe the common IRS agent is today here in our society. People didn't like the tax collectors, but they came around anyway. They also had a calendar, and then they had a math system as well. And they actually taught math in their schools, and they added up figures, and they were very good at things like math. Now, the reason I mention that is because archaeologists have often, at least liberal ones, have often divided various periods of time up as follows. They've said, like, the Stone Age was from 10,000 to 4,000 BC, and the Bronze Age, in which man only worked with bronze and did not yet work with iron, was from about 2500 to 1200 BC, and then the Iron Age was not until 1200 to 330 BC. And so they didn't start working with iron until around 1200 BC. And the interesting thing here is that most archaeologists that are really honest will tell you that these categories no longer apply because there are so many exceptions to them. And this is one exception to this whole scheme right here. And in fact, they've uncovered iron blades and so forth that were made as early as 2700 BC, which is before the flood, 2700 BC. In fact, let me give you a list of some of the things they've uncovered in great quantities. I mean, they've got museums filled with this stuff, and these are all from pre-flood cities, all made before the time of the flood. They've got, for example, like painted pottery. They've got tools that are made out of metal. They've got turquoise vases, vases that are carved out of turquoise. Now, to be honest with you, I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that. They've got copper axes. They've got hoes, sickles, fish hooks, underground kilns. There are many brick ruins of the temples that are painted red or covered with plaster. They would plaster their buildings, and often the buildings would be just brilliant colors, like a brilliant orange, a brilliant red color, a brilliant yellow color, so they were plastering their buildings. The pottery is often very artistically painted in intricate geometric patterns, and I mean very intricate patterns. And they also have chariots that they've discovered, figures of birds, and so forth. And what it really boils down to is that these people apparently had always been familiar or acquainted with the use of metals and the arts and so forth, which goes right along with Genesis chapter 4, verses 19 through 22. Let me read it to you here, talking about this very area. And see, this is like 2,000 to 3,000 years ahead of what they should be on the archaeological scale. But Genesis chapter 4, verse 19, talking about early civilization here right after the time of the fall now. And Lamech took on him two wives. The name of the one was Ada, the name of the other Zillah. And Ada bare Jabal. He was the father of such as dwell in tents and of such as have cattle. Then it talks about Jubal in verse 21. But in verse 22, and Zillah, she also bare Tubal-Cain, an instructor of every artificer in brass and iron. And it's talking about he was a craftsman, and he instructed others in this as well, and he was a craftsman in brass and in iron. See? And so this goes right along with what we see with the Sumerians here, which is a point of confirmation as far as the Bible is concerned. And I've got a real strong opinion myself personally about ancient cultures, and here's how I believe it happened. I believe that man in the Garden of Eden had a great deal of knowledge, even in the natural realm. And I believe that as man left the Garden of Eden, he took that knowledge with him. And as he was dispersed, he had a great amount of natural technical knowledge as well. And they took this to these ancient societies. And then as man walked away from God and fell into pagan idolatry and turned from the Lord, darkness began to come into their minds so that they lost much of the light that they once had. And if you look at Egypt, for example, the pyramids are built taking the circumference of the earth into account, which means that they knew that the earth was round, and they knew that the earth revolved around the sun, and they knew the distance of the earth from the sun, and they knew things like that that was lost for literally thousands of years. How did they know that? Well, the picture is that man started off with light because he was in contact with God, and then as man left God, darkness came into his mind, and the societies lost much of the knowledge they once had. And it took a long period of time, and it was not until man started turning back to God again, and there were societies rooted and founded on the one true God, that God began to impart to them the true knowledge. And you'll find that the most advanced societies have been those that are in contact with God, like America and Great Britain and the other European nations that have turned to God are by far the most advanced societies, by far. They're the leaders, and all the other countries and paganism and idolatry are in darkness and way, way behind the rest of the world. So that's how I look at it. Now, going on with Sumerian religion, that's my opinion. Later on, I might be able to bring, the class has been cut down a little bit, so I have to kind of cut out some information, but I've got a number of facts that are documented, about a number of different ancient cultures that just did things that will, you know, just baffle your mind, including finding little planes in some of the ancient Egyptian tombs and all kinds of things like this, a battery in the Egyptian tombs and all kinds of things that a lot of people are not aware of, showing the incredible light and knowledge that they did have. Well, the Sumerian religion, the Sumerians worshipped what was called a pantheon, which means they had several gods. They had, it didn't take men long to fall into idolatry. Pantheon, which is spelled P-A-N-T-H-E-O-N, pantheon. And the average person was a member of the village family, and if you were born, you were automatically born under a certain god. And you were born under that god, and that was your god. You didn't choose your god. You were born in a certain village, and every single village had their own gods. And so all of a sudden you were raised worshiping those gods with your ency over you. It's kind of like being born a Catholic or whatever. You're a Catholic not because you chose to be one, but rather because you were born one, see? And so as they were born, they obviously did not choose what god they wanted to worship. They were loyal to their own city god, just like they would be to their own father. And every single accomplishment that was achieved in life was always attributed to the god that they were under. And they had gods for everything. They had, for example, a god of the war. They had a god of the crafts. If you were a carpenter and you made something beautiful, then you always ascribed the glory to the god that was over you in that area. And then if you lost a war and you were fighting against another city-state, it was because your god of war was weaker than their god of war. And you can read about that, and it's carried over into even Bible times in 1 Kings chapter 20 and verse 23. 1 Kings chapter 20, verse 23, and also verse 28. 1 Kings 20, verse 23, and verse 28. And there I think it's talking about maybe a group of the Canaanites or whatever, and they're taunting Israel, and they're saying, well, you defeated us because we battled you in the valley, and your god of the valley is stronger than our god of the hills, but we'll take you on the hills, on the mountains, and our god of the mountains is stronger than your god of the mountains, and we'll defeat you on the mountains if we can't defeat you in the valley. And that was their idea of their gods. They were over certain areas.
Is it likely that might, it sounds like it might be even true what they said, and in that, you know, they're under their own, each family has its own demon, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And that there's some truth in what they said.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Although, that's true. Because, see, they worship, later on we'll see, the Babylonians worship demons. They did. They knew it. They practiced exorcism. They had incantations and everything. Yeah, they were involved in demonism, very definitely. But then they also had a number of rituals and festivals, and they kind of went like this. They had their god housed in their temple, and often the temple was on top of the ziggurat. And they would clothe him, and he had finely woven garments, and they would feed him daily. Here's an idol now made out of wood or stone. And the priest would take the food up to the idol. Of course, he never ate it. It was always there when he came back. But they believed that the idol was their god. They believed that the image was their god. And the priest would go up there, and they would entertain him daily. They would sing hymns to him. They would sing praises to him, bring food to him. And not only that, but if an invading army would come into your city town, they would try to carry off your god, because if they could carry off your god, then they overcame you. And this went on all the time. And you would go against another city and try to carry off their god. And that was a real tragic thing for them, to not have their god all of a sudden, and he was gone. And then at regularly specified times of the year, and they had certain times that they did this, they would actually throw a party for the gods. And they had a staff that was in charge of this, and they had festivals, and later on we're going to look at one of these festivals. But the gods from the surrounding cities were invited, and they would bring them on carts or on barges, and they would put their gods, and they would dress them up, and they would put them on these carts, and they would take them over to celebrate with the other gods and bring them there to the host temple. And there were crowds that filled the streets, and it was a time of great, great joy for them. And then they had a phenomenon that they called the dying gods. They believed that often their gods died. fact, certain gods died every single year and then came back to life every single year. Because, particularly in the light of the fact that they had the god of vegetation, and he was in charge of the vegetation. And every single fall, wouldn't you know it, he died. This god of vegetation died. The leaves turned brown, and all the plants died, and the harvest was over. So they believed, and they taught, that their god died. And then animal life would often languish during the hot summer months because the god of the animals had died. And so what they then believed is that in the springtime, the trees began to come back to life again, and the crops began to grow again, and so forth. And what they believed is that the god came back to life now, that he was resurrected from the dead, because that was his job to cause the crops to grow. So what the priests would tell the people then is the reason that the crops... revived. And then if you look at the behavior of these gods in the tablets, and they talk about this, they're very human. They're filled with fits of anger. They're filled with fits of jealousy and lust. They lie to each other. Now, this is the gods that do this. They lie to each other. They deceive one another. They commit every single conceivable kind of violence. They become drunk. They're sick often. They're sleepy. And even they die upon occasion, you know. Well, you know what this tells me? Is that the best that man can do as far as inventing a god? He invents a god after his own imagination, after his own nature. And the God of the Bible is so far different from that. All of a sudden you start reading about the God of the Bible, and it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth and everything. And it's a majestic, elegant picture of God in contrast to all the other early heathen gods that we have. And there's a lot of scriptures that bear this out. For example, in Psalm chapter 115 and verse 1 and following. Let me read a scripture here to you that goes along with this. Psalm chapter 115 and verse 1. David talked about Yahweh in contrast to the heathen. He says, not unto us, O Lord, not unto us, but unto thy name give glory, for thy mercy and for thy truth's sake. Wherefore should the heathen say, where is now their God? But our God is in the heavens. He hath done whatsoever he hath pleased. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths, but they speak not. Eyes have they, but they see not. They have ears, but they hear not. Noses have they, but they smell not. They have hands, but they handle not. Feet have they, but they walk not. Neither speak they through their hands. They that make them are like unto them. So is everyone that trusteth in them. In other words, man makes a god that is like himself. And then man worships that god, and then man in turn becomes like the god that he worships. It's a vicious circle, see? But we've got a god that's not like them. He's in an entirely different arena as far as gods are concerned. So we can praise God for that. Well, then there was one ancient Sumerian city, and I'm only going to talk about one. It's called Ur of the Chaldees. Have you ever heard of that town, Ur of the Chaldees? Well, it wasn't a little cow town that Abraham came out of. Let me tell you about it. It was quite an impressive place that Abraham grew up in. This is where Abraham was from. Ur of the Chaldees. Now, Abraham lived after the time of the flood. Ur of the Chaldees, that's spelled... E-U, and then Chaldees is C-H-A-L-D-E-E-S. It's mentioned in Genesis chapter 11, verse 28. Let me read it to you. Genesis 11, 28, it talks about Ur of the Chaldees. It says here in chapter 11, verse 28, God called him out of this place, and Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldees. And then look at chapter 12, verse 1. Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee. That's talking about Ur of the Chaldees. Significant thing here is that this was one of the formal cities of ancient Sumer and the ancient Sumerians. It rose to prominence several times in its history. Actually, it's got two periods of history. One period is before the flood, and one period is after the flood. And it was a city before the flood, and then the flood came and destroyed it. And then after the flood, it was rebuilt again on the very same location. And there have been a number of clay tablets discovered that actually talk about this very region right here and actually mention this very city. And this very city has actually been uncovered by archaeologists. And the extent of the city is just really mind-boggling if you think about it. And this is the home of Terah and Abraham and his ancestors. Let me tell you a little bit about it. It was once a seaport at the mouth of the Euphrates River. Now, if you look on a map, it's located way up here. But at one time, the Persian Gulf ascended all the way up to Ur. It was actually on the Persian Gulf, and the Euphrates and Tigris River dump a tremendous amount of sediment into the Persian Gulf, about 70 to 100 feet per year. So over the years, of course, this has been filled in, so Ur is no longer right on the Persian Gulf. But at one time, it pretty much was, right there as a seaport city on the Persian Gulf. Very important trading post. And it was excavated by an archaeologist, C.L. Woolley, in 1922 to 1934 with some 200 workmen. Now, he found something very interesting. He excavated the city, he dug down through it, and uncovered basically the city that Abraham had lived in. And then he told his archaeologist to dig down below the existing city. And as he was digging down below it, he found an entire layer of sediment 3 to 11 feet thick. And he dug in several places to confirm that it was a consistent layer of strata. And so they were digging down through it, and they were just about ready to give up. In fact, most of the archaeologists said, that's it. We've uncovered as deep as we can go. There's nothing below this. And Woolley said, well, let's just dig a little bit deeper. And so they dug a little bit deeper down, and they uncovered another entire city below that. And it was just almost as advanced as the city sitting on top of it. And so it was a pre-flood city, and then it had been covered by silt 3 feet to 11 feet thick, and they can tell it's silt that comes from a flood, and it's of a clay nature and so forth, without any artifacts or anything else in it except for a few animal bones. And then on top of that, there's another city built. So you've got a pre-flood city, and the city that Abraham lived in was built on top of that pre-flood city. Well, let me tell you how extensive it really was. Just preceding the time of Abraham, and then shortly after he lived there, it was the most magnificent city in the then known world. It was a center for manufacturing. It was a center for farming, for shipping, and for trade. In fact, they found actually extensive concrete docks. They had concrete docks along the Euphrates River. And there were ships that would sail up this Persian Gulf and dock right at the city of Ur, where Abraham lived. And there was a harbor there. There were many commercial buildings there. And then the ships would sail down from these docks down the Persian Gulf, and they had cargoes of copper and hard stone. And then there were caravans that left from every direction, as far as the Fertile Crescent is concerned, from the city of Ur, and then go all the way over to India as well. So it was a center for the caravans as well. And so that's significant. They found numerous two-story homes. They found many of them. You know, the whole town is filled with these. And they had courts in them, in which they would go out in the courts, and they had open courts. They had fountains in them with water in them. So evidently they had like aqueducts bringing water down into the city. They had fireplaces. They also had sanitation systems. That's pretty advanced, you know, during the time of Abraham, sanitation systems. Population was estimated at about 250,000 people now, 250,000 people. A lot of people living there. There was also a very strong military fortification around the city. There's the wall that still remains. It's about 70 feet thick and about 80 feet high. And then also the government was what is called a pagan theocracy, just like we've seen with the Sumerians. They had a pagan god ruling over them, and this god was over the city of Ur. They had a temple, and then it was very common for them to have temple prostitutes, and that was involved in this as well. And then the ruler over them was the chief priest, and they were extremely polytheistic. They worshipped a number of different gods. Now, you see, this is why God said, Abraham, get out of this city. God appeared to him and said, get thee into a land that I will show thee. And God took him entirely out of that culture. A lot of it was because God could have never done with Abraham in that culture what God desired to do. And here are the scriptures for that, God calling him out of that. In fact, Abraham's very father worshipped idols, was a pagan idolater. And that's found in Genesis chapter 12, 1 through 4. Genesis chapter 12, 1 through 4. And also chapter 15 and verse 7. Chapter 15, verse 7. And then we have Nehemiah chapter 9 and verse 7. And then Joshua chapter 24 and verse 2. Joshua 24, verse 2. And then Acts chapter 7, verses 2 through 4. Now, if you're like me, the concept I had of Abraham is this guy that lived in a tent somewhere, And I mean, you know, he drank out of goatskin bottles, and he's chasing his goats and his sheep around and everything. And later on, he did become very wealthy and did travel around in tents. But he came from a society that was very advanced. In fact, they found inside the city homes with shops in them. They found schools and chapels to the gods. They found thousands of tablets here. And these tablets, many of them are business documents, many of them are business contracts, many of them are receipts. They also found a very well-developed educational system. They could read, they could write, and the children that grew up here actually went to school, and they would write on the tablets, and they learned how to read and write. They learned math and grammar as well. And so there's a good possibility that Abraham was very sharp. He very possibly could read and write. And so really, the whole picture changes a lot here when you start looking into this. They also had a ziggurat right in the heart of Ur of the Chaldees. A ziggurat, which is what we mentioned up here, which is a terraced tower built of solid brick with successive terraces, and they had certain temples built to certain gods up at the top of that. Brother Frank, did you want to say something? No, this is actually the post-flood, right? During the time of Abraham, which is later on. But they did, when they dug down through, they did find another entire society that is also very, very advanced as well. Well, I don't know if it's just as advanced as this, but in certain regards, it apparently was. From what I've read, they found like metal implements, and they found a number of other items as well. But a lot of it, of course, was destroyed and so forth when the flood came, so it might be kind of hard to really determine how advanced it was. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
He looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Oh, he left? By faith Abraham, when he was called, left? Yes, right. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what it's talking about. He left the Ur of the Chaldees, and then he got waylaid. What was the name of that city? Haran. He got waylaid in Haran, was it? And stayed there because of his father, Terah. And then he eventually went down into the Promised Land. But it was this city of Ur of Chaldees that he was called out of. One final point I want to mention. There are two. Incidentally, if you're wondering where I get a lot of this information from, there's a number of different sources that I've culled it from. But there's one major source that will really help you, and that's Wycliffe's Historical Geography. If you desire this type of information, he talks to a certain degree about a number of these facts, because sometimes it's good to know where you can find this information. But incidentally, there were two royal tombs that they discovered there, and they're the tombs of Queen Shubad and Mescalum Dug. And Mescalum Dug was the king. But anyway, in these two royal tombs, they found just very, very rich items. In fact, they found the actual bones of Queen Shubad. And they found there buried with her a golden crown, and Wycliffe has a picture of this now, a golden crown, a headdress, great profusion of beads, necklaces, ornaments of gold, silver, semi-precious stones. And they found cups, plates, saucers, a golden harp there. They also found the bones of 40 court servants, and these court servants were sacrificed and buried with her to serve her in the next world, see. And so they found that. And if you look at this headdress, you'll find it is finally tooled. And it has all these etchings in it and everything. It's a very fine piece of work done out of gold. And the gold is real thin, and it has leaves in it and everything, a very beautiful item. So that's there too. Well, let's move on. Let's talk about the real first Bible empire or kingdom that's really talked about in the Bible, and that's ancient Babylonia. Ancient Babylonia. Ancient Babylonia. And that's spelled B-A-B-Y-L-O-N-I-A. Ancient Babylonia. It's also called, in the Bible, Shinar. The land of Shinar. The land of Shinar, spelled S-H-I-N-A-R. It's also called the land of the Chaldeans. The land of the Chaldeans. And that's seen in Jeremiah chapter 24 and verse 5. Jeremiah chapter 24, verse 5. And then Shinar is mentioned in Genesis 10:10, the land of Shinar. Genesis chapter 10, verse 10. The capital of Babylonia was Babylon, ancient Babylon. And I think the real significant point to observe here is that Babylonia really was just an extension of the Sumerian culture, that they pretty much took over what the Sumerians were doing. In fact, there are many similarities between the two cultures. And the Ur of the Chaldees is right here, and Babylon is just upstream here on the Euphrates River, and eventually Babylonia included the city of Ur. And so there's many similarities, including the languages. Well, let's talk about ancient Babylon there, another fascinating culture, ancient Babylon. You'll notice on the map it's in the southern section of Mesopotamia. So Babylon is to the south, and ancient Assyria is to the north. And again, Babylon is bordered on this side by the Zagros Mountains, on this side by the Arabian Desert, and up here to the north by ancient Assyria. And in ancient Babylon, that is very possibly the site of the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden is very possibly located here. And that's seen in Genesis 2:14. Genesis 2:14. I've seen a slide of what the Arabs presently say is the Garden of Eden, and they do have a site. You can go visit it there. It's got a black iron wrought fence around it, and there's one tree in the whole thing, and it's just a desert out in the middle of nowhere. And the Arabs say that's the ancient site of the Garden of Eden. Heaven only knows, but it probably isn't. Probably isn't. I don't think anyone really knows where that site was, but at any rate, they believe that it was. It's also the probable site of the Tower of Babel. See, the Tower of Babel, the word Babel means confusion, later became Babylon. In fact, many archaeologists theorize that they've actually uncovered the Tower of Babel. And a lot of them are really dogmatic about it, too. They say, and you can see it, it's a ziggurat there. They say, that is the Tower of Babel. I don't know if it is or not, but many of them say that it is. Well, there are two great periods of Babylonian history, two great periods that I'm going to mention. First one I'm going to spend just a few minutes on. Second one I'm going to take time to elaborate on. The first one is called the Ancient Golden Age. The Ancient Golden Age, and that is from 1830 to 1550 BC. The Ancient Golden Age from 1830 to 1550 BC. Now, that's the very time that Israel is down in Egypt, during this very time. And there was one ruler that is found in history books. His name is Hammurabi. And he was the premier ruler during this time. Hammurabi. And that's spelled Hammurabi, the greatest ruler during this time. He reigned from 1728 to 1686 BC. 1728 to 1686. Probably a number of you have heard about Hammurabi. His reign was one of the greatest in Babylonian history. It was a time of great prosperity, many advances in astronomy. And the Babylonians were really known for their astronomy. In fact, a lot of the zodiac and a lot of the things that are connected with the occult and so forth go back to ancient Babylon. But they made many advances in astronomy and architecture and many advances in mathematics and literature. And during this time, they produced things like dictionaries in which they had their vocabulary words written down in them, many mathematical treatises, many cuneiform writings on various topics. One of the big things that Hammurabi did, though, he united all the cities of Mesopotamia, which was kind of a first. They had always been kind of divided. But he united them, set up a royal postal system, set up a new network of roads. But really, the most notable deed that he did, he organized the laws of Mesopotamia in a very simplified law code. And it's called Hammurabi's Law Code. Have you heard of that? Hammurabi's Law Code. Okay, well, that's something that he did during this time. Now, what he wanted to do, he wanted a standard source of justice throughout his entire kingdom. He wanted a standard. So he took a number of the laws that he had passed or was instrumental in enforcing, and he wrote them on stone pillars. And he put them all throughout his kingdom so that if you had a question on what the law said, you could go to the nearest column or pillar and you could read on there in the Akkadian or Babylonian language exactly what the law was. And he did that to try to provide a standard legal procedure. Well, archaeologists have uncovered one of these copies of his law. And they discovered it back in 1901. They discovered it at Susa, which is in the kingdom of Elam right here on our map, which is real close to his kingdom. And evidently his kingdom either extended over to that area or someone carried it over there, but it dates all the way back to the time of Hammurabi. It's a very, very beautiful find. It's actually a slab of black diorite. It's about 7 feet tall, and it's about 6 feet wide, and it's the longest Babylonian inscription found. There's almost 300 paragraphs in it with about 4,000 lines, and they're very neatly done. You can see pictures of it in books on archaeology. Very neatly done. And so you can read about them, and there are laws that cover every single facet of life, the social life, the domestic family life, the moral life of the Babylonians. Let me read to you some of the laws that are found in this, some of the different laws. And this is found in Light from the Ancient Past by Jay Finnegan. That's pages 59 through 60. First of all, it starts off in the prologue, and now Hammurabi is talking. Here's what he says. He says, "The gods named me to promote the welfare of the people, me, Hammurabi, the devout, God-fearing prince, to cause justice to prevail in the land, to destroy the wicked and the evil, that the strong might not oppress the weak, to rise like the sun over the black-headed people, and to light up the land." And the Babylonians called themselves the black-headed people. They had black, shaggy, curly hair. So he's saying that we've got these laws so that righteousness will prevail. Now, he goes on and he talks about some of them. Let me mention some. Let me read some to you. He says, for example, procedure in the law courts had to be taken very seriously, for false accusation in a capital case was ground for death. So if you lied on the witness stand, off with your head. Theft in certain cases, kidnapping and housebreaking were punishable by death. In the case of stealing at a fire, the thief was to be thrown into the fire. Other laws dealt with the duties of soldiers, regulated farm rentals, deposits and debts. Marriage was legal only when recorded in writing, and the woman as well as the man had the right of divorce. Death for both parties was the penalty in the case of adultery between a man and another man's wife. But a woman accused of adultery without proof might clear herself by swearing her innocence or by the ordeal by water. And this ordeal of water consisted of leaping in the sacred river where sinking was proof of guilt and floating of innocence. So if you were accused of adultery, you had your option. You could either swear that you were innocent or jump in the river. And if you drowned, then you were guilty. And if you swam ashore, you were innocent. Then it goes on and it says, if under certain circumstances a man caused the death of another man's daughter, his own daughter was to be put to death. See, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. The fees of physicians were governed. And in the case of an operation, now they had doctors that were operating on people. In the case of an operation under which the patient died, the doctor's hand was to be cut off, which is kind of hard to operate from that point on with your hand cut off. Likewise, if a builder erected an unsafe house which fell upon its owner and killed him, he himself was liable to death. River navigation, rental of cattle, wages of laborers, and numerous other matters were covered in the code. So, end quote. It's pretty interesting that all those laws. And then later on, what the liberal said is that, well, you know where Moses got his laws, don't you? Because, see, Hammurabi is writing this way back in 1600 B.C., in 1700 B.C., and Moses came along in 1450 B.C., a couple hundred years after this, and Moses had many of the same laws. In fact, he even had a test to test a woman that was accused of adultery. And the eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth and being liable for injury to your neighbor's property or animal life and so forth. So many of them said, well, you know what Moses did? He copied from Hammurabi. But really, let me tell you what I really think is happening here is that man has a conscience. And God has given man that conscience. And so therefore, there's a certain common law in the minds of man. Man knows it's wrong to kill. He knows it's wrong to steal. He knows it's wrong to do this. And so he recorded these things, but it doesn't mean that Moses copied Hammurabi. I don't think they were walking around in the wilderness with one of these huge diorite stones and that Moses was copying that. No, not that shaggy prophet of God.